In 1910, a mild-mannered doctor and his disguised mistress fled across the Atlantic, unaware they were making history. The pursuit of Dr. Hawley Harvey Crippen became the first criminal manhunt conducted through wireless telegraphy, transforming both justice and communication forever. Eric Larson's Thunderstruck masterfully weaves together two seemingly unrelated stories: Guglielmo Marconi's obsessive quest to transmit messages through thin air, and Crippen's desperate flight after murdering his wife. The book captivated readers worldwide, earning praise from Stephen King, who called it a ripping yarn of murder and invention. Its exploration of how technology transforms society remains startlingly relevant today, as we grapple with how modern communications reshape our world. The story has influenced countless works, from Alfred Hitchcock films to detective novels, cementing its place as both a gripping true crime narrative and a pivotal account of technological revolution. In the summer of 1894, 20-year-old Guglielmo Marconi read an obituary of physicist Heinrich Hertz that sparked an idea so revolutionary it would transform human communication forever. While escaping the Italian heat in the Alps, Marconi conceived a method to send messages through air using Hertz's invisible electromagnetic waves. What seemed obvious to him appeared fantastical to the scientific establishment, a kind of electric telepathy deemed impossible by experts. Marconi possessed unique advantages that allowed him to succeed where established scientists had failed. His lack of formal scientific training meant he wasn't constrained by theoretical limitations. His mother Annie, an Irish Protestant with connections to British society, had protected him from rigid Catholic education, instead providing tutors who focused on physics and electricity. From childhood, Marconi had been fascinated by electricity, possessively calling it my electricity, a fitting interest for someone born near Bologna, where Luigi Galvani had conducted his famous frog experiments. His formal schooling was sporadic and unimpressive. Teachers considered him poorly suited for academics, calling him the little Englishman with a defective memory. Yet he possessed remarkable gifts, including perfect pitch, an ability to sight read and mentally transpose music. These talents reflected his extraordinary spatial intelligence and pattern recognition, skills that would prove crucial for his work with invisible waves. While established physicists like Oliver Lodge demonstrated electromagnetic waves in laboratory settings, they believed these signals couldn't travel more than half a mile. Marconi's breakthrough came through methodical experimentation in his attic laboratory at Villa Grifone, where he worked obsessively in stifling heat. He refined the coherer, a glass tube containing metal filings that conducted electricity when struck by electromagnetic waves, making it smaller and more reliable than previous versions. His persistence paid off in September 1895, when his brother Alfonso carried a receiver over Celestine Hill, completely out of sight about 1,500 yards away. Marconi pressed his transmitter key, and moments later, a gunshot echoed through the countryside. Alfonso signaled that he had received the transmission. This simple experiment proved what experts thought impossible. Wireless signals could travel beyond visual range, over hills, and through obstacles. Recognizing the importance of his discovery, Marconi and his mother traveled to London in February 1896, where his family connections introduced him to William Preece, chief electrician of the British Post Office. Despite Marconi's youth, good English, good suit, and lucid explanations impressed Preece, who recognized that the young Italian had elegantly combined existing components to achieve what others thought impossible. This meeting began a partnership that would launch wireless telegraphy into the world, though it would eventually fracture under the weight of commercial pressures and personal ambitions. In the bustling world of turn-of-the-century London, Dr. Hawley Harvey Crippen and his flamboyant wife Belle Elmore lived a life that appeared respectable on the surface, but concealed profound unhappiness. Crippen, a small, mild-mannered American homeopathic doctor with thick glasses and a neatly trimmed beard, had first met the voluptuous, temperamental Cora Turner, who later adopted the stage name Belle Elmore, in his Brooklyn office when she was just 17. Despite his unimpressive physical appearance, Crippen possessed certain advantages: warm, sympathetic eyes, sophisticated manners, and the growing prestige of his medical profession. Their marriage in 1892 began with complications. Cora revealed her real name was Kunigunda Makamotsky, though she continued using Cora. Born in Coldwater, Michigan during the Civil War to a prominent Methodist family, Crippen had enjoyed a privileged childhood despite his grandfather's austere religious practices. His medical education was unconventional, studying homeopathy at the University of Michigan without graduating, then continuing his education in London, where the medical establishment received him with skepticism. He found acceptance at Bedlam Asylum, where his knowledge of compounds like aconite, atropine, and hyoscine proved valuable. The couple's relationship deteriorated after moving to London in 1900, where Bell pursued her theatrical ambitions while Crippen struggled financially. Her operation in America had left her unable to bear children and with a distinctive 4 to 5 inch scar that her sister later described as cream-colored and paler than the rest of her skin. This childlessness became the only shadow in their lives, though Crippen seemed less concerned, having already sent his son from a previous marriage to live with grandparents. Bell dominated their household completely, making Crippen tend to boarders' needs even on his day off, cleaning boots, shoveling coal, making beds, and washing dishes. She controlled his clothing choices and kept a photograph of her former lover, Bruce Miller, displayed as a constant reminder of her threat to leave him. Crippen later confessed, "I have always hated that house at Hilldrop Crescent, where they moved in 1905. To neighbors, the Crippens appeared to have an ideal marriage, gardening together while Bell sang, never quarreling publicly. However, those closer saw a different reality. They spoke little together and occupied separate bedrooms. Bell's loneliness manifested in her collection of pets and taking in boarders, while Crippen endured her volatile temper and constant threats to leave him for other men. One boarder described Bell as excitable and irritable, chiding her husband, Crippen, pale, quiet, imperturbable. Meanwhile, Crippen found comfort in his relationship with his secretary, Ethel Leneve, a slender young woman with large gray eyes who had begun working for him in 1901. Their relationship deepened after Crippen collapsed following one of Bell's angry outbursts. By summer 1904, they had become romantically involved, with Ethel discovering Bruce Miller's letters to Bell, which relieved her misgivings about their affair. The stage was set for the tragedy that would eventually connect their story to Marconi's wireless revolution. As Marconi's wireless technology gained prominence, he found himself embroiled in bitter disputes with the scientific establishment. Oliver Lodge, a renowned physicist who had demonstrated electromagnetic waves in 1894, led the opposition, feeling Marconi had stolen his work and received undue credit. Lodge hired an attorney and filed patent applications for his own wireless innovations, writing to the Times to assert that Marconi's method was essentially what he had shown years earlier, deriding the absurd language about Marconi waves and brilliant novelties. The conflict intensified when William Preece, once Marconi's champion, delivered a Royal Institution lecture demonstrating Marconi's technology while mockingly attacking Lodge's earlier claim that Hertzian waves couldn't travel beyond half a mile. The scientific community condemned Preece's tone, with the Westminster Gazette noting that bitter retorts and jeers were not marks of scientific spirit. Marconi's secretive approach and commercial ambitions further alienated the academic community. On July 2, 1897, just 5 days after Preece recommended the government pay a mere $10,000 for Marconi's patent rights, Marconi founded the Wireless Telegraph and Signal Co. in London without Preece's knowledge. Marconi received 60,000 shares, 60% ownership, plus 15,000 cash. Within 6 months, his shares tripled in value to $180,000, about $20 million today, making the 23-year-old both famous and wealthy. international competition complicated matters further. Kaiser Wilhelm II had taken notice of Marconi's achievements, intending to incorporate wireless technology into Germany's imperial ambitions. Adolf Slaby, the Kaiser's private scientific advisor, observed Marconi's experiments at Salisbury Plain and quickly constructed replicas of Marconi's apparatus upon returning to Germany. Despite his warm thanks and expressions of scientific brotherhood to Marconi, Slaby harbored grander ambitions, soon marketing his own wireless system with enthusiastic backing from Kaiser Wilhelm and powerful German investors. Recognizing his need for allies against Lodge's opposition and public skepticism, Marconi courted Lord Kelvin, one of Britain's most revered scientists. Though initially skeptical, "Wireless is all very well, but I'd rather send a message by a boy on a pony," Kelvin visited Marconi's offices and later his Isle of Wight station. Impressed after sending his own wireless message, the first paid telegram and first revenue for Marconi's company, Kelvin tentatively agreed to become a consulting engineer. Marconi's breakthrough came when Queen Victoria requested he establish wireless communication between Osborne House, where he was staying, and the royal yacht 2 miles away in the Solent. Despite initial difficulties with palace staff, Marconi charmed the 79-year-old monarch. Over 2 weeks, the Queen, Edward, and his doctor exchanged 150 messages, mostly mundane updates about the prince's knee. Edward was delighted with the technology and gave Marconi a royal tie pin. Despite these successes, Marconi faced continued resistance. Trinity House showed interest but offered no contract. Lloyd's might have continued using his system if Priest hadn't shut it down, citing postal monopoly rules. Public suspicion persisted, with rumors that wireless could blow up warships. Competition intensified as Reginald Fessenden in America, Eugene Ducretet in France, and German physicists all advanced their wireless work. With the race for wireless distance heating up, Marconi realized he needed a more dramatic demonstration than anything previously attempted, something so daring it might cause nightmares for his board of directors. Marconi's audacious plan to transmit wireless signals across the Atlantic defied established physics. Scientists believed electromagnetic waves traveled in straight lines, making transmission impossible across the curved Earth. With 14 submarine cables already carrying millions of words annually, many questioned the need for wireless. Yet Marconi saw commercial stagnation as the greater risk. He needed something dramatic to prove his technology's power. The scale of stations required dwarfed anything he'd built previously. He recruited physicist John Ambrose Fleming, who initially expressed skepticism, but by August 1899 believed transatlantic transmission possible with sufficiently tall masts. In October 1900, construction began on a massive station atop Angros Cliff near Poldhu, Cornwall. Marconi designed the antenna, while Fleming worked out power amplification details to create waves capable of crossing the Atlantic safely. The extreme power raised concerns about interference with other stations. Meanwhile, Fleming published an effusive letter in the Times praising Marconi's tuning abilities without disclosing his employment relationship, an omission that caught the attention of skeptical magician Neville Maskelyne, who would become one of Marconi's most persistent critics. Disaster struck in September 1901 when a violent gale caused catastrophic failure of Poldhu's antenna system. Despite this setback, Marconi refused to postpone his transatlantic experiment. Within 7 days, his team erected a temporary antenna with 2 160-foot masts supporting 54 copper wires in a fan shell configuration. He then devised a new plan, selecting Signal Hill in Newfoundland, closer to Britain than his Cape Cod station, but still across the Atlantic for his receiving station. On December 12, 1901, despite a furious gale engulfing Signal Hill, Marconi and engineer George Kemp launched a kite with antenna wires into the howling wind. Rather than using automatic recording equipment, Marconi connected his receiver directly to a telephone handset, the human ear being far more sensitive than the recorder. At the appointed time, Marconi held the telephone receiver to his ear, hearing only static and wind, while the Poldhu operator began transmitting the letter S, three dots. At about 12:30, Marconi's receiver clicked, indicating it had detected waves. He heard three sharp little clicks corresponding to three dots multiple times. Doubting his own perception, he asked Kemp to listen, who confirmed hearing the same pattern. "I knew then that I had been absolutely right in my calculation," Marconi wrote. The electric waves which were being sent out from Poldhu had traversed the Atlantic, serenely ignoring the curvature of the Earth, which so many doubters considered would be a fatal obstacle. Marconi's announcement revealed critical errors in judgment. He had failed to provide independent witnesses or record the signals automatically, eliminating physical evidence that could have corroborated his claims. Despite knowing skeptics would scrutinize his extraordinary accomplishment, he relied solely on his own credibility, a costly miscalculation that would haunt him for years as critics questioned whether he had truly achieved what he claimed. On January 31, 1910, Paul and Clara Martinetti visited the Crippens for dinner despite Paul feeling unwell. After the meal and a game of whist, Paul's condition worsened. When the Martinettis departed, Belle's demeanor dramatically changed. She flew into a very great rage, berating Crippen and shouting, "This is the finish of it. I won't stand it any longer. I shall leave you tomorrow and you will never hear of me again." Unlike previous threats, Belle added something new, that Crippen should arrange to cover up any scandal with our mutual friends and the guild. What Belle didn't realize was that her threat had lost its power. Crippen had fallen deeply in love with Ethel Leneve and promised to make her his legal wife someday. Belle's departure would be a blessing, as desertion was one of the few grounds for divorce under British law. However, the situation took a darker turn. On January 15, 1910, Crippen had visited Lewis and Burroughs chemists requesting 5 grains of hyoscine hydrobromide, an exceedingly dangerous poison rarely used. The clerk, Charles Hetherington, couldn't fill the order immediately as the shop didn't keep such quantities in stock. In 3 years, Hetherington had never known the shop to have that much on hand. 4 days later, Crippen returned to collect his order and signed the poisons book listing homeopathic preparations as the purpose. He received a small container of tiny crystals weighing only 1/100 of an ounce, yet potent enough to kill 20 men. The next morning after Belle's threat, Crippen left for work before she awoke. When he returned home that evening, Belle was gone, leaving behind only the pets. Crippen told friends and colleagues that Belle had returned to America, and over the following weeks, he sent letters to the Music Hall Ladies Guild, where Belle served as treasurer, explaining her sudden departure due to a relative's illness. When Ethel Leneve arrived at work on February 2nd, she found a note from Crippen stating, "B.E. has gone to America," thrilling her with the prospect that Belle had finally left him. Crippen then surprised Ethel by giving her several of Belle's diamond rings and jewelry, claiming Belle had abandoned them. Ethel accepted the gifts and that night slept at Hilldrop Crescent for the first time. As Belle's absence continued, Ethel grew increasingly confident, openly wearing Belle's jewelry and appearing publicly with Crippen. She flaunted her new possessions to her landlady, Mrs. Jackson, showing off diamond rings, gold watches, and bracelets. When playfully asked if someone had died and left her money, Ethel replied delightedly, "Somebody has gone to America." The couple grew increasingly bold in displaying their relationship. Despite initial reluctance, they attended the annual Music Hall Artists Benevolent Fund banquet at the prestigious Criterion Restaurant. Ethel wore a new pale pink dress and Belle's rising sun brooch, which immediately caught the attention of the guild ladies, who recognized it as Belle's favorite piece. On March 20, Crippen wrote to Clara and Paul Martinetti, claiming he'd received very bad news from Belle, who was dangerously ill with double pleuropneumonia in America. 4 days later, he sent a telegram announcing, "Belle died yesterday at 6 o'clock. This fabricated death would set in motion the events that would eventually connect his fate to Marconi's wireless technology in a way neither could have imagined. Bell's friends grew increasingly suspicious of Crippen's story. First she disappeared, then she allegedly died, but the details made no sense. Guild members Clara Martinetti and Louise Smytheson confronted Crippen, who claimed Bell had contracted pneumonia on her voyage and been cremated. This shocked them, as Bell had never mentioned wanting cremation. When they pressed for details, Crippen confusingly claimed she died at his son Otto's home. Mrs. Martinetti wrote to Otto, who replied a month later that he was surprised by his stepmother's death and that she had actually died in San Francisco, contradicting his father's story. For John Nash and Lil Hawthorne, news of Bell's death came as a shocking surprise. Upon returning to London from a trip, Nash visited Crippen and found him nervous and evasive about the details. When Nash pressed him about where she had died, Crippen couldn't remember the exact location, saying vaguely it was Alameo, near San Francisco. Nash became suspicious when Crippen couldn't name the crematorium or produce a death certificate. 2 days later, on June 30, the Nashes visited Superintendent Frank Frost at Scotland Yard's murder squad. Chief Inspector Walter Dew, nicknamed Blue Serge for always wearing his best suit on duty, was summoned to hear the Nash's concerns. At 47, Dew was a veteran detective who had investigated the Jack the Ripper murders in 1888. Though Dew didn't initially suspect foul play, the Nash's connection to Superintendent Frost and Lil Hawthorne's status as a well-known performer convinced him to investigate personally, reasoning, "It is better to be sure than sorry." Over 6 days, Dew gathered information about Bell's relationship with her husband, learning she was a great favorite who typically had her own way with Crippen. On July 8, 1910, Dew and Sergeant Mitchell visited 39 Hilldrop Crescent, where they encountered Ethel Leneve, who claimed to be the housekeeper. Noticing she wore what appeared to be Bell's diamond rising sun brooch, Dew convinced Leneve to accompany them to Crippen's office at Albion House. When Dew met Crippen, he found him an insignificant little man with blue, slightly protruding eyes amplified by thick spectacles. Despite the gravity of the situation, Crippen appeared completely untroubled, smiling and shaking hands. Dew formally explained he was investigating the stories about Mrs. Crippen's death, which her friends found unsatisfying. Crippen immediately responded, "I suppose I had better tell the truth," admitting his stories were untrue and that, as far as he knew, his wife was still alive. Crippen answered all questions without hesitation, appearing as a much maligned man eager only to clear the matter up. Though lacking legal authority, Dew obtained Crippen's permission to search the house. They found evidence of packing, Bell's extensive wardrobe, with enough ostrich feathers to stock a milliner's shop, but nothing suspicious. Dew even checked the coal cellar, finding only coal, wood, and a brick floor with a fine layer of dust. After the detectives left, Ethel confronted Crippen about his lies. He insisted he didn't know Bell's whereabouts, but had fabricated her death to avoid scandal. Now their reputations would be destroyed, especially Ethel's. When she asked what he intended to do, he replied ominously, "My dear, there seems to me only one thing possible to do." On Saturday morning, July 9, 1910, Crippen left for his office and instructed his assistant William Long to purchase boys' clothing. Meanwhile, Ethel took a cab to her sister Nina's home for a hurried, emotional goodbye. After changing into the boys' outfit, white shirt, suspenders, tie, vest, brown jacket, and pants, she met Crippen, now without his mustache, at the Chancery Lane station. They traveled to Liverpool Street Station and boarded the night boat to Holland. The next day, they continued to Brussels, where they checked into the Hotel des Ardennes as John Robinson and John Robinson Jr. When Chief Inspector Dew returned to Albion House on Monday, he learned from William Long that Crippen had left Saturday with a suitcase. The detectives rushed to Hilldrop Crescent, where the French-made Lecoq informed them that Crippen and Leneve had departed, likely for good. Dew arranged for Lecoq to be sent home and distributed flyers with descriptions of Crippen and Leneve to police at ports. Following his instinct, Dew and Mitchell search the cellar a fourth time. Using a poker, Dew discovered loose bricks, which they removed to find disturbed soil beneath. Upon digging, they encountered an unbearable stench that drove them outside for fresh air before returning to uncover decomposing human tissue. The discovery transformed the case. Dew called Superintendent Frost, who arrived with Assistant Commissioner McNaughton bearing cigars to counter the stench. McNaughton summoned forensic pathologist Dr. Augustus Pepper and authorized full resources for the investigation. Dew prepared a worldwide circular titled Murder and Mutilation with photographs and detailed descriptions of both suspects. Meanwhile, Crippen and Ethel, now calling themselves the Robinsons, booked passage on the SS Montrose, scheduled to depart Antwerp for Quebec on July 20. For the passenger manifest, Crippen identified himself as John Philo Robinson, a 55-year-old merchant from Detroit, and disguised Ethel as his 16-year-old son, John George Robinson. On Wednesday morning, they boarded the Montrose in Antwerp, carrying only a single small suitcase. Captain Henry George Kendall was unusually attentive to the pair, noting their strange behavior. During lunch, Kendall searched their cabin, finding a hat stamped Jackson, Boulevard du Nord, Bruxelles, and noting that the boy's hat was packed with paper to improve its fit. Kendall shared his suspicions with First Officer Alfred Sargent, who confirmed his captain's assessment. Kendall continued his subtle investigation of the Robinsons. He noticed marks on the father's nose where spectacles would rest, observed the son's feminine manner of filling out clothes and ladylike table manners, and spotted safety pins holding together the boy's pants. On the third day at sea, Friday, July 22nd, as the Montrose passed beyond the English Channel, Kendall composed a wireless message to Canadian Pacific's Liverpool office. Have strong suspicions that Crippen, London cellar murderer, and accomplice are amongst saloon passengers. Mustache taken off, growing beard. Accomplice, dressed as boy, voice, manner, and build, undoubtedly a girl. Both traveling as Mr. and Master Robinson. Kendall. Kendall's wireless message traveled at the speed of light to Poldhu's receiving antenna, where Marconi's Maggie detector activated a Morse inker that produced the tape with blue dots and dashes. The message was relayed to Canadian Pacific's Liverpool office, then to Scotland Yard's murder squad. At 8 in the evening, an exhausted Dew was chatting with a colleague when the telegram arrived. His fatigue instantly vanished as he read the captain's authoritative report. After checking shipping schedules and making several calls, Dew contacted CID Chief Sir Melville McNaughton at home. Despite concerns about leaving Scotland Yard during other murder investigations, they decided Dew should pursue the suspects. McNaughton authorized the mission, codenamed Handcuffs, and Dew departed on the White Star liner Laurentic under the alias Dewhurst, hoping to overtake the Montrose by a single day. The news of Crippen's pursuit exploded across global headlines. Scotland Yard's brief statement that Dew had left for Canada to intercept the fugitives triggered a media frenzy, with newspapers publishing Atlantic maps showing the relative positions of the Montrose and Laurentic. The Daily Mail offered a $100 reward for information, while editors marveled at wireless technology's power to trap criminals at sea. Captain Kendall reveled in the attention as his modest ship became the most famous vessel afloat. He prepared detailed accounts for the Daily Mail about the fugitives' daily activities, knowing his wireless messages would be distributed worldwide. Meanwhile, Crippen and Leneve remained utterly unaware of the messages rocketing around them. As they entered the Gulf of St. Lawrence, Crippen grew anxious, giving Ethel money and suggesting she might need to continue alone to Toronto after their arrival. The London press published Kendall's dispatches describing Leneve's ill-fitting boy's clothes and Crippen's reading habits, creating an intimate portrait that thrilled readers worldwide. As the Times noted, there was something intensely thrilling, almost weird, about these passengers traveling across the Atlantic, believing their identities were secret while their whereabouts were being broadcast globally. One Marconi engineer wrote that wireless had forever altered criminals' prospects, as the very air around him may be quivering with accusatory messages. Ironically, Crippen himself once admired the wireless antenna, telling Kendall, "What a wonderful invention it is!" Inspector Dew rose before dawn with the reporters, but realized his original plan wouldn't work. The journalist-packed pilot boat would alert the fugitives. Instead, he borrowed the chief pilot's uniform as disguise and approached the Montrose in a separate rowboat with Quebec inspectors. Boarding the ship, Dew went directly to the bridge where Captain Kendall discreetly gripped his revolver while introducing him to Mr. Robinson. Removing his cap, Dew quietly said, "Good morning, Dr. Crippen." After a moment of changing expressions, Crippen calmly replied, "Good morning, Mr. Dew." When Dew visited cabin number 5, Ethel immediately recognized him despite his disguise and promptly fainted into his arms. Crippen's trial began October 18, 1910, with such intense public interest that 4,000 people applied for tickets to the Old Bailey, including Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and W.S. Gilbert. The turning point came when handsome 33-year-old pathologist Bernard Spilsbury confidently testified that marks on recovered skin indicated a surgical scar consistent with removal of ovaries, evidence passed among jurors on a soup plate. Despite defense challenges from two opposing physicians, Spilsbury's composed testimony won over the jury. 2 days after the arrest, detectives discovered Crippen had purchased 5 grains of hyoscine hydrobromide in January. Dr. Wilcox confirmed this was indeed the alkaloid found in the remains, extracting 0.25 grain from the available tissue. Just 0.25 grain could be lethal. After just 27 minutes of deliberation, the jury returned a guilty verdict. Ethel's subsequent trial ended with acquittal, as jurors believed she knew nothing of the murder. Transferred to Pentonville Prison in his old neighborhood, Crippen was processed, examined, and given prison garb. His appeal failed, and in a final letter to Ethel, he maintained his innocence while acknowledging his fate was sealed, writing, "They would meet again in another life." At precisely 9 a.m. on November 23, 1910, hangman John Ellis released the trapdoor, breaking Crippen's neck cleanly at the 3rd cervical vertebra. The Crippen saga accelerated wireless adoption more effectively than any of Marconi's demonstrations, with newspapers daily extolling the miracle of wireless communication. Public demand grew for mandatory wireless on all ocean-going vessels, though this effect was overshadowed by the Titanic disaster 18 months later. Marconi and his wife Beatrice were supposed to sail on the Titanic as guests of White Star Line, but Marconi departed earlier on the Lusitania, while Beatrice canceled when their son fell ill. After the disaster, England's Postmaster General declared, "Those who have been saved through one man, Mr. Marconi, and his wonderful invention." Marconi's work quickly evolved into the wireless transmission of voice and music. In 1920, Dame Nellie Melba was invited to sing over the airwaves from the Marconi station at Chelmsford. By 1926, wireless still amazed passengers at sea, with one traveler marveling at receiving a telegram 2,000 miles into the Atlantic. Marconi later realized his approach to wireless had been mistaken. He'd focused on increasing antenna length and transmitter power, when short waves could travel long distances more efficiently. "I admit that I am responsible for adopting long waves," he confessed in 1927. "Everyone followed me in building stations hundreds of times more powerful than necessary." He died of a heart attack on July 20, 1937. That evening at 6 o'clock, wireless operators worldwide halted telegraphy for 2 minutes of silence. For perhaps the last time in human history, the great hush prevailed across the airwaves. As for Ethel LeNave, she boarded the White Star Line's Majestic in Southampton on November 23, 1910, traveling under the false name Miss Allen. After arriving in New York, she went to Toronto, adopted the name Ethel Nelson, and worked as a typist. Finding Canada alien, she returned to London in 1916, despite submarine-infested waters. There she met and married Stanley Smith, raising 2 children in East Croydon, without ever revealing her past to him. The intersection of these two stories, Marconi's technological revolution and Crippen's desperate flight, marked a pivotal moment in human history. For the first time, a criminal could not escape justice simply by crossing an ocean. The world had become smaller, more connected, and infinitely more difficult to hide in, a transformation that continues to shape our lives today.